Hello, I'm David Cross from Bowtie Tours, and today we are chasing history. Specifically, we are going to be looking at the Constitution. This is the fifth program on our Constitution series, and we are going to be talking about Thomas Jefferson. I am sitting here today with Chip the poodle sitting in my lap, so I'll see how much of this program I can do with a dog in my lap. He doesn't like it when I spend a lot of time on the computer or at the desk. It kind of pisses him off because he thinks I should probably be spending time with him, and so he feels like he needs to sit on my lap. So anyway, I'm sitting here with Chip on my lap, and I am very excited because today we're going to be discussing Thomas Jefferson. And before we get to that, though, let me give a shout out to some people I always like to tell you about, and that's the Great Courses series. The Great Courses provide lectures on all sorts of different subjects. They have lectures on the American Revolution, lectures on the Civil War, they have lectures on music. I'm looking at their sale that they have right now, and they are offering martial arts for your mind and body, do-it-yourself engineering, sewing 101, zoology. So those are four that are new releases that are coming out. I particularly love the Robert Greenberg programs. He does programs on classical music, and you could probably care nothing about classical music and still enjoy these programs because Robert Greenberg does such a good job, and he's so passionate and he's so knowledgeable that you can't help but enjoy what he has to say about the music, and you can't help but be improved and really be able to hear the music on a new level. He's somebody who's such a genius, but he's able to talk to people and do lectures to people even if they don't know how to read music, even if they don't play an instrument or anything like that. So that's one of my personal favorites. There's a number of other programs that I've enjoyed through the years. You can purchase them directly online. They go straight on your phone. You can listen to them as you go to work or when you exercise. So that's something I definitely want to recommend to you. Now, before we get started, I have another... By the way, last week I made a little joke because I was talking about the series and I said, well, there was a law school for everyone, and I said, don't take that. That was just a little joke because I was a lawyer, so, you know, don't take that too seriously. Somebody wrote in and said, why shouldn't I get the law? I was going to get the law course. So I had to write them and say, no, definitely get it. Sure, it's fine. It was just my little, you know, just a little joke. So anyway, I received an email from a listener of the program named Eliana, and Eliana is 11 years old, and she's been listening to the program, and she wrote in to ask me if I could put together a Hamilton program. She also told me that she drinks chocolate milk when she listens to the program. I think this is a wonderful idea. I don't know if it's her dad's idea or her idea, but I think everybody out there, anyone who listens to me, you should have chocolate whenever you hear my voice. Every time I'm talking, have more chocolate. And soon, it's just going to give you such pleasure just to hear my voice, you won't even need the chocolate. So it'll just add to the pleasure of listening to these lectures. So I think you should do what Eliana does. Always have some chocolate or chocolate milk or chocolate milkshake, something like that, whenever you listen to Chasing American History. As to the Hamilton, I think that's a great idea. I think in January I'll try to put together an episode about the Hamilton musical, about those things that the musical gets historically right, and about those things that the musical changes in terms of the history of Hamilton, and some things you can argue about. You know, I'm a fan, all right? I understand that when you're making a musical, it's not all going to be exactly historically accurate. So this is not going to be a program where I'm trying to get aha moments or, you know, show that I know more than they know. They had to make some changes for the drama of the program. And anything that gets young people excited about history and does so in an honest fashion, I think is a wonderful thing. And I've had a number of people, evidently Eliana is a fan, and I've had a number of people take tours here in Philadelphia. By the way, just so you know, Philadelphia is where Alexander Hamilton runs into Mariah Reynolds, and we all know where things go from there. And if you don't, well, we'll talk about that when we do that Hamilton episode in January, hopefully. But anyway, thank you very much for writing in, Eliana, and continue to drink chocolate milk. If you're listening right now, you should be having some chocolate milk right now. If not, you know, tell your father. You don't know what's going on here. So anyway, thank you for that idea. Now, today we're going to discuss Thomas Jefferson. And let me backstep a little bit just to tell you why it is I'm going through so many of these biographical discussions of these people before we hit the real meat of the subject, which will be next week as we get to the actual Constitutional Convention. There's two basic reasons I do this. Number one, these are the people who are going to be involved in the Constitution. Jefferson, of course, isn't going to be there, but his involvement will be felt, as you'll hear in the upcoming weeks. Obviously, Madison's going to be there. Benjamin Franklin's going to be there. So as I'm telling you about these people, I'm trying to tell you who they are so that as we discuss them during the Constitutional Convention lectures, you have a better understanding of where they're coming from. You know, the Constitution didn't just arrive out of nowhere. It's like growing a plant in a particular type of soil. You have to have a particular type of soil for certain plants, and this was the soil that created the Constitution. These are the ideals behind the Constitution. So when you hear about James Otis and you hear about the writs of assistance, you're not only hearing what I hope is an interesting story, but you're also hearing about somebody who's fighting for these ideas which are going to become part of the Constitution. You know, there are things that are in the Constitution that only history provides the reason why they're there. I mean, you might wonder, well, why on earth is there this business about quartering soldiers? Well, obviously, that was something that bothered a lot of Americans, the fact that the English would order them to turn their houses over and to house their soldiers. And they made that part of the Constitution. The government cannot require that. There's things about paper money in the Constitution, and we're going to hear the reasons behind them. So anyway, that's one of the reasons, is to know the people. And the other reason is to understand the background that the Constitution comes out of. And there's nobody better at explaining this background, nobody better at explaining the ideals behind the new country than Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson, the man who was not there at the Constitutional Convention, the man who has a lot of issues with many things that are in the Constitution, but a person who really defined in many ways what this country was and in many ways what this country is. I mean, Thomas Jefferson is a very special figure in our story. I should begin by admitting that I like Thomas Jefferson. It's kind of a confession at this point in the world because there are so many people who detest Thomas Jefferson. You know, it wasn't, a few weeks ago, his statue in Charlottesville, Virginia, somebody wrote rapist and racist on there. And, you know, I only have to bring up Thomas Jefferson to my wife to know that not everybody likes Thomas Jefferson. She has no fondness for this man, considers him a rank hypocrite. He is, of course, a rank hypocrite. I mean, I can't defend many things that Jefferson did during his life. There is no defense. And so I wrestled with all of this for a number of years. As a child, he was the guy who I connected with the most because he was kind of the solitary artsy guy. You know, I loved John Adams. Loved him in 1776. But Jefferson was more like the way I considered myself. He was quieter. He was more withdrawn. He was alone more, you know. One of the great moments of the Revolution is Thomas Jefferson sitting alone at his office in 6th and Market Street, sitting alone in there and writing and thinking. Just like one of the great moments of jazz history is when Charlie Parker went by himself to study his instrument at that woodshed. And people to this day, if you're practicing, if you go to Berklee School of Music, and you know, what did you do last night? I shedded. I was shedding. That means I was practicing. It goes back to Charlie Parker, who went off to a woodshed by himself. You know, a lot of the work that goes on in this revolution, and a lot of the work that goes on in this Constitution, comes from people, you know, people you might call grinds, who are studying, who are reading, who are thinking. You know, Madison and Jefferson, James Wilson. These are people who are wrestling with issues of ancient history and with issues of right versus wrong and with political issues. And they're doing it quite often alone in a room, thinking, writing notes to themselves. We don't do this enough, you know? We're so concerned telling everyone on Facebook every single thought we have that we can't stop enough and sit in a room and think. And these were guys who spent just hour upon hour. You know, it's said that Thomas Jefferson would spend 15 hours a day reading. And I think Madison probably did the same thing, if not something close to it. Jefferson had this voracious appetite for knowledge. You know, never was interested much in being a lawyer. He was a lawyer for a while. But he was what you call a gentleman lawyer. He did it for a few years. He really had no interest in it. He really doesn't want to argue, for one thing. He has no desire to bicker with people in public. He'd rather avoid that and be a gentleman and have a you know, congenial conversation over a nice bottle of wine. That's what Jefferson would like. Doesn't want to go bickering with people. After a lot of time struggling with this, I've come to the conclusion that what Jefferson believed in, I believed in. Now, he failed his own vision many times, but his beliefs, he was able to express so beautifully and so poignantly that they exist today. You know, what he believed in was an America very far from the one we have now. And this is where a lot of people will argue about the Hamilton portrayal. You know, they show Hamilton as in a very heroic light. Well, he wasn't a hero to Thomas Jefferson. He was taking this beautiful idea of Eden, a place where people controlled their own destinies, a place where people probably went out and they worked on their own land, but they weren't manipulated by large sources outside their control, weren't manipulated by the government, weren't manipulated by big money, weren't manipulated by businesses. He wanted a country that was different from all of the other countries. We wouldn't need a giant army. We're not invading anybody through arms. We're going to invade people. We're going to invade countries through our philosophy. We're going to live in a way that ensures perfect freedom to everybody. We're going to allow people to worship whatever God they wish to worship, or no God if they wish to worship no God. And that's not going to bother us. We're going to feel that that's part of what makes the fabric of this country. We're not going to have a giant difference between the very rich and the very poor. This was the Jeffersonian ideal. This was what he sought to protect when he did his battles with Hamilton and with George Washington and with John Adams. You know, I run into a lot of people, and I think I've said this before in these broadcasts, who complain about Jefferson being a false friend and so forth, and I have to remind them that they were fighting over the future of humanity. That's what Jefferson was doing. He was fighting for the freedom of all mankind. You may be aware of the famous quote, which appears at the Jefferson Memorial, "For I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man." Think about that, against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. He's talking about something more than what our Constitution promises. Our Constitution promises that the government itself will not be tyrannical. He's trying to create a country where there's no tyranny at all, where your neighbor is not going to be tyrannical. Think about that. He's trying to create a country where, you know, what he said about, if my neighbor worships many gods or no god at all, what bother does that give me? It neither breaks my leg nor picks my pocket. A land where people allow other people to worship as they please and believe as they please, as long as they're not harming anybody. This is the meaning of liberalism to him. You know, not a liberalism that says Ann Coulter can't come make a speech. A liberalism that says, okay, if she wants to make a speech, let her make a speech. We may want to make a speech in response, but we're not going to shout her down. As a child, when I visited Monticello, I just absolutely loved the place. I loved the way the doors opened simultaneously, doors that had been carved so carefully and lovingly that they still had not been oiled up to that time. I loved the clock that Jefferson could see what time it was by looking right up. I loved all the different little inventions. And as I come back, I still love a lot of these things, but I also have to see them through the prism of slavery. And that's part of being an adult. That's part of us as a country being adults. Yes, we can love what Jefferson provided for us. We can love the philosophical beauty of his concepts and the practical usefulness of his concepts. But at the same time, as we look at him as a person, we have to judge him accordingly. I mean, you know, I loved the fact that he invented the dumbwaiter to bring food up, but I now realize that that was done because he was ashamed and embarrassed of slavery. And he did not want to have slaves coming in. He had people who were eating with him who were from other countries, and he understood that slavery was a blight. Now, this isn't a discussion on Jefferson and slavery, but when you discuss Jefferson, you have to discuss Jefferson and slavery a little bit. There's no way around it. And that's kind of the choice he made. He didn't do enough. And you can argue, as John Meekham does, well, he was just a pragmatist. He could have done more. He could have done more as president. Someday we'll have an episode on that. But needless to say, although I cannot love Jefferson wholeheartedly as a person, I love his philosophy wholeheartedly. I love the idea that he has of the government only interfering with people's lives when it's required to do so. And I understand and love his beliefs of when it's required to do so. It's required to do so, for instance, in order to protect beautiful landscape. He wanted the government to be able to protect... Got another message from my daughter. For those of you wondering, last time I got a message from her. She was in Greece. Now she's in Beirut. She is in Beirut. So, you know, this is... For Eliana's father, this is what happens when you give your child knowledge and confidence as a child, you end up getting emails saying, "Dad, I'm at Beirut." So anyway, but Jefferson creates a beautiful philosophy that he is not able to live up to, but that we still struggle to live up to as a country. You know, Albert Camus once said, "We define ourselves by our make-believe." And perhaps that's what Jefferson did. Perhaps to Jefferson, his words and his ideals were enough. Jefferson himself would write, "Every human being must be viewed according to what it is good for none of us, no, not one, is perfect. And were we to love none who had imperfection, this world would be a desert for our love." No, we have to judge these people honestly. It's not enough to say we're judging 18th century people by 21st century standards, because these were the best and the brightest, and they knew slavery was wrong. Thomas Jefferson said slavery was wrong. So we can't give him a pass. On the other hand, I, for one, choose to admire his positive aspects. At the same time, I have to accept the negative ones. And his positive aspects comprise his view of this country, which is, to me, one of the most beautiful concepts that have ever come about. Jefferson was born on April the 13th. By the way, let me say something very briefly. We are going to do a Jefferson tour during Jefferson's birthday. And that's a tour that begins in Philadelphia. And that's a tour in which we're going to visit where he actually wrote the Declaration of Independence. And we're going to visit the room where he argued about independence in the Continental Congress of 1776. We're going to go out to Virginia, and this is a several days goes on for this tour. We're going to see one of his favorite spots, Natural Bridge, and stay the night out there. We're going to see Chartwell, which was his second home. We're going to see Monticello, which is, of course, the home that he built himself, and there's a lot we can say about that. We're going to visit James Madison's home in Montpelier, because as we take this trip, there are a lot of discussions between us all. And much of what we're going to discuss is the partnership between Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, I think probably the most important partnership in the history of our country. And we're going to finally celebrate his birthday in Williamsburg. And we're going to toast him at Raleigh's Tavern, which was a very tavern that he used to enjoy going to. So if anybody is interested in this, we're still kind of, we're going to make some changes on the website in terms of this and put the date on there. But please feel free to give us a call at 610-642-2410. It's going to be the week of April 13th that we're going to be doing this tour. So please let us know if you have an interest in doing this with us. You know, visiting these places is, of course, great fun, but a lot of the fun comes from the travel and the conversations we all have with each other and the discussions that we have about Jefferson and just learning together. There's never a time that I don't learn from these trips as well as everybody else, and I certainly enjoy meeting people who are interested in American history, people who want to bring their kids into it. This is certainly a kid-friendly tour, and it also takes place in some of the most beautiful parts of the country. So please give us a call and let us know if you're interested in joining us for our next Thomas Jefferson tour. Anyway, he's born on April the 13th in Albemarle County, Virginia. He's born on a plantation called Shadwell. Jefferson's, one of his great biographers is a guy named Dumas Malone. Dumas Malone, who wrote this beautiful 6-volume biography of Thomas Jefferson, which I would still recommend. It's a little dated, but in a lot of ways, it's still the best book out there. There's other very good books on Jefferson. I'm looking over at my bookcase as we speak. There's The American Sphinx by Joseph Ellis. I met Joseph Ellis a couple weeks ago, by the way. He came out to Philadelphia, and he gave a subpar speech, and then he was very grumpy about signing books. And I wanted to say, you're probably getting $5,000 for this. Just, you know, sign the books. He was only signing books for 15 minutes, really. But I showed up with 4 books, which I thought was pretty kind, considering I could have brought 8. And then he wrote, and I always say, put my name on, because I think it's kind of insulting if you say, don't put your name on. Aren't you really saying that you want to sell the book or something? So anyway, I said, yeah, my name's David. So he wrote my name on the first one, and then he said, well, I'm not writing your name on every one of these. I don't have the time. So anyway, he's still a great writer, people, but just so you know, that's what he said. He wrote a very good book on Jefferson called The American Sphinx. Other great books on Jefferson. One of my favorites is a book about Jefferson and Madison. It's by Andrew Burstein and his wife, Nancy Eisenberg, or perhaps I should say Nancy Eisenberg and her husband, Andrew Burstein. They're both tremendous writers. Burstein, you can see if you watch the Ken Burns DVD about Thomas Jefferson. He was one of the people who was interviewed for that. That's a tremendously, tremendously good book. Annette Gordon Reed has just written a new book on Thomas Jefferson, which I have not read. I've read The Hemingses of Monticello, which goes into the whole issue. Well, really, The Hemingses of Monticello is more of a biographical treatment of Sally Hemings and the Hemings family, and she's a very good scholar. There's going to be a new book, it's already come out, a new book about the relationship between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. Now I have one in this bookcase by John Furling, who's one of my favorite writers, Adams versus Jefferson, and there's a new one that's been written by Gordon Wood, so you might be interested in giving that a look. I haven't had the opportunity yet to read the Gordon Wood book. The John Meacham book I've already told you about. I met him, by the way, and I had him sign 4 books, and he was very nice and a gentleman about it, I should say. And he was happy to sign my name on each of them, I believe. Let me see here. Yep, put my name on the book. Yes, he did. And I gave him, I had him sign 4 books as well. So anyway, I don't know, however, whether I'm entirely sold on his point of view with Thomas Jefferson. I think there's more to it than pragmatism. I think most people, it's like what Bob Dylan says, we don't do what's right, we do what's most convenient and then repent. Jefferson isn't Jefferson without Monticello. Jefferson is this gentleman who wants things that are entirely suited to his tastes and style. And Jefferson can't afford all that, but he's going to have all of that. He feels privileged. He feels like he should have what he wants. I mean, if somebody invents a new telescope, he should have it. Whether he can afford it or not, he should have it. I mean, that's really part of Jefferson. And at the end of the day, him having the stuff he wants is probably more important to him than freeing human beings. I mean, if he could free all of his slaves but not have Monticello, or keep his slaves and have Monticello, I have the bad feeling that he would keep his slaves and have Monticello. And as to his presidency, Jefferson could have done more as president. Jefferson could have pushed on this subject, and he didn't. He didn't lift a finger, quite frankly. And I think we have to accept that that is a part of Thomas Jefferson. But anyway, John Meekham is a very good writer. It's always very easy to read what he says. One of the issues I have with Meekham as kind of a history geek is that his notes almost always are to secondary sources. And I'd rather, you know, on the one hand, okay, at least he's being honest, right? Like, a lot of people find it in a secondary source, look up the note on the secondary source, and put the citation on that way. He doesn't do that. On the other hand, why am I reading somebody who's citing me secondary sources? I might as well read those secondary sources, is kind of my attitude. I still think if you really want to delve into Jefferson, you read Dumas Malone. Okay, I'm not normal, but I like six-volume books. I like to live through the whole life with a person. And Dumas Malone does not lose his credibility as a writer. I mean, he's a fan, you can tell that, but I think he's a good historian and an honest historian. You know the story about the great biographer of Robert E. Lee, Douglas Southall Freeman. It is said that he had a statue of Lee right outside where he lived, and before he would work on his biography, he would go out and salute the statue. I'm not sure that's exactly the relationship I want between a biographer and a subject. Another book I like a lot about Jefferson is by Clay Jenkinson. Clay Jenkinson's another individual who's on that Ken Burns series, and this is a very small book. It's called Becoming Jefferson's People: Reinventing the American Republic in the 21st Century. I really love this book. This is what convinced me I'm a Jeffersonian. And it's part of what convinced me to somewhat forgive Jefferson in my own heart and go ahead and accept that I actually am a fan. I realized that it's his doctrines that reflect what I personally feel, far more than doctrines of being a Democrat or a Republican in today's world, or even a conservative or a liberal in today's world. I think of myself now as a Jeffersonian. And Clay Jenkinson's book is the thing that kind of brought me around to that. He talks about the way Jefferson lived, his philosophy and things like exercise and reading and all sorts of things like that, and his general principles and how they in some ways might be enacted in modern days. It's a very nice book, Becoming Jefferson's People. I'm not sure it's available. I think it might be. You might want to Google Clay Jenkinson. He has a podcast about Thomas Jefferson that's a marvelous podcast. And you might be able to purchase the book through him. Worth doing. Okay. All right. Already I can see that this is going to have to be two episodes. I'm sorry. My teacher used to call diarrhea of the mouth, my old college teacher. But when it comes to Jefferson, that's sometimes how I get to be. We haven't even started, have we? He's born April 13th in Shadwell. And his first memory is riding horseback on a pillow and feeling, as he remembered it, secure in the arms of a slave. And he was riding from Shadwell, his birthplace, to Tuckahoe at the age of 2 or 3. Tuckahoe was where he's going to move. Now, his last memory he's ever going to have is also going to involve a slave. He's going to be requesting that his head be elevated, and his family members don't understand exactly what he's saying, but his slave does understand him. So, as far as we can tell, his first memory is about slavery, and his last memory, probably, is about slavery. Thomas's father is Peter Jefferson. He was a kind of an adventurous frontiersman. He was large, he was strong, and by the time Thomas Jefferson is born, he's considered among the gentry of Virginia. So Thomas Jefferson has a fairly privileged childhood. He's brought up with the knowledge that he's going to be given every educational advantage. Now, this idyllic childhood is going to be shattered by his father's death. when Thomas Jefferson is only 14 years old. Among Peter Jefferson's last directives were that Thomas receive a classical education. And Jefferson wrote this in his autobiography: "When I recollect that at 14 years of age, the whole care and direction of myself was thrown on myself entirely, without a relation or friend qualified to advise or guide me, and recollect various sorts of bad company with which I associated from time to time, I am astonished I did not turn off with some of them and become as worthless to society as they were." Now, from the very beginning, Jefferson's time was spent on education and in self-improvement. He's placed in English school at 5. Latin school at 9. His teacher teaches him French. He's then taught the classics by a Mr. Mari before moving on to the College of William and Mary. And it is said, as I think I already mentioned, that for many years it was his habit to study for 15 hours a day. Now, to understand Jefferson and what he was studying and what he becomes, it's necessary to have some understanding of the Renaissance and the excitement that the Renaissance had over people like Thomas Jefferson. It seems like today we have this very anti-intellectual bent. It's the first time many people would willingly like to go into the Dark Ages. We now live in a time where we believe what we want to believe. It's as simple as that. And if it comes to science, we believe what we want to believe. If it comes to, criminal cases, anything, we have people who want to, believe in a certain political agenda, and they watch one show, and people believe in a different political agenda, and they watch another show. So you get two points of view, okay, but you even get disagreements on facts. You get disagreements on science. If you don't want, we have a vice president who still doesn't seem to believe that cigarette smoking is bad for your health. It is. The Enlightenment was the idea that we're going to find the truth about things. We're not just going to believe something because we want to. We can't just believe that the earth is in the center of the universe just because that makes us feel good. That's not the way knowledge works. We're going to find out how things really work. Now, the Enlightenment was what James McGregor Burns called a revolution in ideas. These were incendiary European ideas about liberty and equality. And Jefferson read these things and he really, immersed himself in these ideals of equality and the Renaissance. When Martin Luther nailed his theses to a church door in Wittenberg in 1517, he didn't just shatter the old order. He challenged all thinking people to join in the search for a new order. It was not to the Pope and his aides that we should look to for the source of knowledge, but instead, each of us should look to it directly through the Bible. And we should interpret it ourselves using our minds. Now, the Pope and others argued that if we liberated the West from orthodoxy, chaos would reign. And it did, as the Reformation ignited an age of strife, as Catholics and Protestants battled for preeminence. And it's the human mind that is going to take center stage through all of this. God was no longer the final answer to all questions. As Alexander Pope put it, "The proper study of mankind is man." Francis Bacon wrote, "Man, being the servant and interpreter of nature, can do and understand so much, and so much only, as he has observed in fact or in thought of the course of nature." John Locke emerges from this revolution of the mind, arguing that the received doctrine that men had native ideas stamped upon their minds in their very first being should be rejected. The mind, he says, is a tabula rasa. And it's going to be filled. It's going to be filled by experience and by education. Jefferson delved deeply into these writings of the Renaissance. He read Hobbes and his State of Nature. He read Descartes and his Triumph of Reason. He read Spinoza and his Freedom of Thought. And probably most of all, he read Locke and his Light of Experience. Education was the key to Locke's argument. He said that education is the key to the growth of mankind, and education should not be limited to only the wealthy, because everybody would rise by education. Inequality isn't inevitable. It's brought about by social and political convention. Now, Locke also argued for religious toleration. The care of each man's soul and the things of heaven, which neither does belong to the commonwealth, nor can be subjected to it, is left entirely to every man's self. He argued that toleration should be granted to everybody, to pagans, to Muslims, to Jews, to everybody. All men, Locke said, possessed the inalienable natural right to lives, liberties, and estates. And government was responsible to assure this. When they didn't do this, it was within the providence of the people to dissolve such a government and to bring about a new one. Now, all these doctrines become Jefferson's mother's milk. As a young man, he was serious, often more serious than all the other kids around him, and he found himself missing out on much of their early activities and sport because he was so invested in reading and learning and discovering these ideas. And so, let's speed up to the breakup between the colonies and Great Britain. Jefferson is young, he's married, he's a lawyer, he's a member of the Virginia aristocracy, and he is a quiet man with burning ideas. As a member of the House of Burgesses, he puts forward a plan of manumission, a plan to release the slaves. It's unrealistic, and he knows, I'm sure, that it has zero chance of success. And it is shot down unanimously, and it's considered heresy by many of his associates. And he's going to make a couple more tentative steps in this direction as a young man before he virtually throws up his hands to the situation and decides that we're going to give this to a later generation to worry about. Now, people in Virginia are more willing to listen to his ideas about ensuring religious toleration than about freeing the slaves. And he is eventually going to draft the bill in Virginia that ensures total religious freedom. No man shall be compelled to frequent or support any religious worship, place, or ministry whatsoever, nor shall be enforced, restrained, molested, or burdened in his body or goods, or shall otherwise suffer on account of his religious opinions or belief. But that all men shall be free to profess and by argument to maintain their opinions in matters of religion, and that the same shall in no wise diminish, enlarge, or affect their civil capacities. As Dumas Malone would write, he went the whole way. He did not limit liberty to Protestant sects or to Christian groups, but extended it to all without any qualification whatsoever. He asserts that the bill should last forever, because it's simply an assertion of the natural rights of mankind. Now, it's through this lens of natural rights that he's going to look upon the growing disagreements between England and the colonies. He believes that his generation is in a particularly advantageous place to create this country that is going to be a virtual Eden. This is a place in which science and medicine and not superstition is going to reign. A place where all are free to worship as they please. A place large enough that anybody who wants land can have it. Anyone who wants to work has work. There's no army in this Eden. There's no need of one. America is cut off from Europe. It's too far away. We don't have to worry about them. And we don't want to invade anybody else. Our army will be our intellect, our theories, our ideals. And where does slavery fit into this rosy picture? As a young lawyer in 1770, Jefferson represented what he called a mulatto man pro bono. The man, Samuel Howell, had a grandmother who was the product of a white woman and a black man. Jefferson argued that one act had made a servant of the first mulatto, and that a later one extended it to her children, but that it remained for some future legislature, if any should be found wicked enough, to extend it to grandchildren. Under natural law, he argued, we are all born free. Now, the person arguing against him is his prior law teacher, George Wythe. And he rises to respond, but the judge waves him down. So for those of you out there who are lawyers, you've already had this experience when you make an argument and the other side says, do I need to respond? And the judge goes, nah. Always makes you feel really good. So especially good if you have, you know, clients there. You kind of hope the judge is going to be nice enough to at least politely listen to an argument as if you've said something worth hearing. But anyway, this judge didn't do that. I've had similar judges. Jefferson's going to write in his autobiography that early in his legislative career, he had made an effort to emancipate his slaves, but, as he said, nothing liberal could then expect success. Now, we've already gone into Meekum and other people who argue that, well, Jefferson was a great believer in equality of the races. He was a pragmatist as well, however, and was only going to attain what he could attain. And we've already talked about that, that I don't quite buy it. You know, people in Philadelphia were shocked to see Jefferson and Patrick Henry and these people who they'd read their writings, and they knew them as people who were opposed to slavery, and here they show up with slaves. And that seemed shocking to people in Philadelphia. Well, part of life of the Virginia gentleman in this time was standing up against British aggression and imperialism. And Jefferson, as a young member of the House of Burgesses, he's liked by everybody, mainly because he's polite, he's quiet, he shies away from argument, doesn't really want to be involved in controversy. But when he writes, that's a different thing. When he writes, he's very controversial. It's his pen that makes him well known to other people in the Congress. It's his pen that makes him well known enough that John Adams asks him to write the Declaration of Independence, and you could argue that it's his pen that makes him famous today. Now, he's going to first enter the large public stage when he writes the Summary View of the Rights of British America as a response to the Coercive Acts of England. We've talked about the Coercive Acts, those acts England conducted after the Boston Tea Party. So when we return next week, we're going to hear about Thomas Jefferson. We're going to finish our Thomas Jefferson. And we're going to discuss the Summary View of the Rights of British America and go from there and discuss his Declaration of Independence and the connection that it has to our Constitution. Chasing American history, chasing American history. We're chasing American history, my friends. We're chasing American history, chasing American history. We're chasing American history, my friends. Oh, Thomas Jefferson came along, so I'll sing this merry song. We're chasing American history, my friends. We needed to make a separation, so he wrote a declaration. Chasing American history, my friends. Oh yes, we're chasing American history. Chasing American history. We're chasing American history, my friends. Oh yes, we're chasing American history. Chasing American history. Chasing American history, my friends. The Congress chose to edit it. Old TJ had a fit. Chasing American history, my friends. He really was an interesting fellow, so he went and built Monticello. Chasing American history, my friends. I will see you all next week. Chasing American history. Chasing American history. We're chasing American history, my friends. We're chasing American history. Chasing American history. We're chasing American history, my friends.